Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
But again, we're talking about a guy in his first pro boxing fight. Here in round 10 against Floyd Mayweather. As Floyd Mayweather landing the right hands now at will and tags McGregor again. Floyd Mayweather has McGregor on the ropes, literally and figuratively. How is the notorious one still standing?
That's it.
McGregor is a stand-up fighter. He's undefeated in the octagon. I just went out there and done my job. My job is to go out there and fight, and that's what I did tonight. I'm not here to knock Marciano or no other legendary fighters. I praise any legendary champion that paved the way for me to be where I'm at. He's young, a guy that's 28, that's active. He's fighting, standing up fighting every day. He started off as a boxer from the beginning at 12 years old before he even moved to MMA. So we're not going to take that. We're not going to discredit him or dog him out. He's a hell of a fighter. He's a stand-up fighter. In the MMA, he only lost when someone got him on the ground in the octagon, whereas in boxing, we fight just standing up from the shoulders.
He fought different because he knew he couldn't fight me the way he normally fights me. He had to change his style. I made him fight. He usually doesn't fight, so I made him come and fight. But look, nothing but respect to him. He came and he fought, and you've got to give respect to that. But I don't feel like I lost a fight. I feel like I lost a match. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Give me a kick in the mouth or something. Do you know what I mean? Put me out. Put me down. I'm fatigued and I'm tired, and then the ref steps in. It felt like you're bleeding amateurs. You know what I mean? That's like something to do with the amateurs. If that was MMA, the ref wants to see a nose hanging off your face before he's even thinking of doing something like that.
That would be the last resort. These are two teams who want to find a way to complete this deal for lots of reasons. It certainly fulfilled the needs of both teams. And so, listen, the two scenarios before that is either Cleveland just signs off on the deal as it is, passes Thomas's physical, and moves on, or they get into a conversation here about adding to the deal, whether that's a first-round pick, a second-round pick, a player, a young player on the Celtics roster. But they're not there yet, and Cleveland is still going through all of their options in this scenario.
And starting a preseason game, but now to know that I'll be the guy heading into the season to help lead this team to a couple wins, this is obviously a really cool experience. Coach Jackson last week, when he called to tell me I was going to start for Tampa, he just let me know that if there's, you know, if all things went as we planned, that I'd be the guy heading into the season. After a good week of practice and obviously going out and growing a little more in this Tampa game, it just kind of fell in line. The drives are there. The playmakers are there. The, you know, we're going out and attacking each drive and playing with speed. That's all there. We just got to finish. You know, I think this last preseason game, whether it be the ones out there, the twos, it's just an opportunity for us on offense to show that we can finish because our defense is playing, you know, great in this last three games. And for us to compliment them, we got to be able to put the ball in the end zone.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to an extravaganza I have been waiting for right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo sports leader. Oh, my goodness, do we have a lot of stuff to get into today. That montage doesn't even begin to do it justice. We have so much more than just what you heard from the knockout. You heard the knockout sequence, or the TKO sequence, if you will, in that montage on Saturday night from The Fight That Would Never Begin. You ever heard of A Fight That Would Never End? It's A Fight That Would Never Begin. My goodness. Pay-per-view delays. Cushland, did you watch it? I knew you said you were going to try to work it out. Did you end up getting a chance to watch it live or not?
I did not get a chance to watch it live, but I heard about the delay issues to start, and I'm like, oh, my goodness.
It was brutal to start. It was right now. I found a bar that was showing the fight for free.
Nice.
So I did not have to put a nickel on the table in order to enrich Floyd Mayweather, which was a big, big thing for me. I told you that. It's a guy who doesn't even pay his federal income taxes on the hundreds of millions of dollars he makes for fights. And so I wasn't going to enrich him with any of my dollars.
But by the way, can I say, since you found that out, I think that deserves a...
Can you
dig it? It does. Thank you. It does indeed deserve a can you dig it. I will take that. Yeah, I found a place, Kush, that did it this way. No cover charge to come in and watch the fight.
Okay.
It just added a dollar to the top of every beer. That's how they did it. Every beer was an extra dollar on top. Now, I didn't drink any beer, so I was golden. I literally didn't spend a nickel on Floyd Mayweather's $300 million night. So I feel really, really good about that. I can tell you that right now. My buddy did. He had about three of them, so he ended up paying $3 for a $99.95 fight if you'd have bought it at home. That's pretty doggone good. So I'm impressed with myself and my friend for that. And I'll stop there. Now, this doesn't even begin. What you just heard there with the TKO, it seemed like the fight was never going to start. And then, shockingly, it did not end. Shockingly to people who didn't understand the sport. You didn't understand the matchup, the styles that were involved in this fight. So I want to get into that. You also heard a little bit in the montage, Adrian Wojnarowski, about the trade issues, about how the Cavaliers are going to be asking for a little bit of extra compensation back in that trade because of the questionable status of the hip of Isaiah Thomas, and potentially even they could rescind the trade. They could just veto the trade and say, nope, no deal. He didn't pass our physical. We're done. We're out. You keep your guy, we'll keep ours, and we'll go back to the block and start looking someplace else. So that was interesting. And then, of course, also on Saturday night, before the start of that fight, thankfully the fight was delayed because we were able to watch a lot of the Browns game, which I did, Kush. I wasn't going to. What did I tell you on Friday? If those players pulled the old let's kneel down and protest the flag and the national anthem stunt again, I'm done with them. I'm not watching. But 1 week after their 12-man protest on the knee during the anthem, every Browns player was on their feet. So that was for during the national anthem. So that was, for me, a very, very big deal. I was glad to hear that. And, or glad to see that, I should say. And one can only wonder how much of an influence the greatest Brown of all time, Jim Brown, had on that decision.
I'm an American. I don't desecrate my flag and my national anthem. I'm not going to do anything against the flag and the national anthem. I'm going to work within those situations. But this is my country, and I'll work out the problems, but I'll do it in an intelligent manner.
I don't think there's any question that from the great Jim Brown deserves.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, buddy. Thank you to the great Jim Brown. He got a message across to some of the Browns players. I don't know if this was at the behest of Jimmy Haslam or how it is they decided to do that, but I promise you, Cushlin, that the Browns switchboard, which lit up literally starting last Saturday when they did the whole knee thing and going through Monday as everybody came back to work, and then Tuesday, I mean, really all week long, they got bombarded. Emails, phone calls, messages, where I want my money back, I'm canceling my tickets, et cetera, et cetera. It was terrible for them. And I don't know if Haslam said, how am I going to get through to these guys without sounding like I'm dictating to them? How do I get through to these guys without making it look like I am depriving them of their freedom of speech? How am I going to get through to these guys to make them want to stand and not do it upon my orders? How about I ask Jim? And here comes Jim Brown, and you heard what Jim Brown had to say. I've got more audio from that as well. So in that game, the Cleveland Browns, by the way, started Notre Dame product, and more importantly to you, Central Catholic High product, DeSean Kizer, in the third preseason game. And as promised, it has come to pass exactly what we said. This wasn't a start to test him. It was a start to ready him. He is going to be the opening day quarterback, the 27th starting quarterback that franchise has put under center since returning to the National Football League back in 1999. An absolutely amazing development there. So we will talk coming up at about 4:10 with Scott Petrak, who is a Browns beat writer and the owner and proprietor of BrownsZone.com. BrownsZone.com. You got to check that out, especially in advance of the conversation if you would like. But I'm looking forward to talking to him about Kizer and about more about the defense. How about Jabril Peppers stepping up, too? An interception at the goal line early on, Kush. I don't know if you got a chance to see that. But the former Michigan Wolverine product It looks like he has solidified his starting spot in the secondary as a safety for the Cleveland Browns. Very, very happy to see that Jabril Peppers is proving he's not just a quote-unquote football athlete. Stick me over here, I can do a little something. Stick me over there, I can do a little something. But I don't have a home. He's got a home, and it's as a safety. And he'll also, of course, you know, be counted on to do a few specialty things here and there. He will return kicks and punts. But Jabril Peppers has played his way into, I don't know if it's probably too soon because it's only preseason to say, becoming a force in the Browns secondary. But as a rookie, making as much of an impact as anybody could have hoped a rookie could make an impact in winning a starting job in the secondary.
Yeah, and it's obviously an encouraging thing to see. This is one of the things we were wondering about from a Browns perspective at camp is what exactly position would he end up settling on. And again, I know it's preseason and all, blah, 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 blah. But I've liked a couple of things here and there, not just Pepper, some of the efforts of Myles Garrett. I've liked some things I've seen on defense, and very interested to see how this start goes. Now, for DeShone Kizer, as he's going to end up getting thrown right to the Wolves against Pittsburgh, of all people, on September 10th. Very interesting.
Welcome to the NFL, son.
Yeah, no kidding.
Here's James Harrison over on the other side. I'm serious, man. It's not something I would wish on people. Okay, so we've got all that to talk about, but we've got to get back to the top story, of course, of the day, and that is reaction to the fight. Was it the fight of the century? No. Was it some sort of a blockbuster, oh my God, can you believe it, were you there when moment? No. Was it a more entertaining fight than a lot of people expected it would be? Hell yes it was, myself included. I'm going to go back and refresh your memory as to what I predicted really for the last several months in this fight and then talk about how wrong I was as well as how right I was. Now, going into that fight, I kind of had my mind made up as I studied it and watched it and looked at it that this was going to be a 12-round unanimous decision for Floyd Mayweather, that Floyd Mayweather would not give up a round because his defensive prowess is far too legendary and advanced for a novice boxer like Conor McGregor to penetrate. He wouldn't give up any points. He wouldn't give up any serious punches, and if he did, he would certainly outpoint Conor McGregor with a whole bunch of light tapping stuff because he's a counterpuncher and not a knockout guy. He doesn't knock anybody out anymore. He hasn't knocked guys out in like 7 years. So I said he'll outpoint Conor in round one, and he'll be continuing to outpoint Conor McGregor through round 12. McGregor won't be able to land power shots against that defensive wizard, and Mayweather won't try to land power shots against McGregor because of that potential knockout that McGregor might have if he got a little sloppy and went after him. So that was my prediction. Obviously, it turned out to be wrong because we had a 10th round stoppage, and Floyd Mayweather did go after Conor McGregor.
Heck, it turns out, Bob, we were wrong after one round, to be honest with you.
Well, we were, but we weren't. We were, but we weren't. And I'm glad you brought that up, Jim, because this is part of the understanding of the science of boxing, the sweet science that it is, okay? When I watched that first round, I said to myself, wow. I looked over at my buddy that I was watching the fight with at the bar for free. Got to keep that up there. And I said, how do you score that? I said, it's got to be McGregor's round, right? Floyd didn't land anything. And then I watched the second round. I said, I'm probably going to give that one to Conor, too. Holy crap. I didn't think he'd win a single round. And then I saw it again in round three, and I said, my God, Mayweather doesn't want to engage. I think Mayweather's afraid of him. And then I saw round four. And after round four, I saw rounds five and six start to do the exact same thing, and that is turn the fight. Starting to see a guy who doesn't fight very long for a living start to be winded, start to fatigue, start to have his cardio fail him in rounds five and in six and in round seven. And by the time you saw him in round eight on the stool, and even while trying to ward off some of the more heavy advances from Floyd Mayweather in the ninth, you could kind of tell that Floyd Mayweather had done exactly what Floyd Mayweather had planned on doing. Cush, Floyd Mayweather employed a version, not exactly the same, but a version of the rope-a-dope that Muhammad Ali invented and trademarked and patented back in 1974 against the massive George Foreman. He didn't lay on the ropes and let Foreman punch himself out. So it wasn't, or in this case, McGregor. So it wasn't identical to rope-a-dope. But Jim, when you say, you know, we were wrong starting in round one, I don't think that Conor McGregor necessarily won round one or round two or round three. And even though a lot of people scored it that way, let me make sure I'm very, very clear on this. He did win them on the scorecards. If I had one, I would have said 10-9, 10-9, 10-9. But what I mean when I say he didn't really win them, Floyd Mayweather had no intention of winning them. Floyd Mayweather used those three rounds to figure out what this awkward switching back and forth from southpaw to right-handed fighter, a guy who was inclined when they got into clinch to slip behind him and grab him because he was in the MMA. Of course, he would throw him down and have a takedown, and then he had to stop. A guy that was patting him on the back of the head as if it was, you know, he was in an MMA fight. Floyd Mayweather used those first three rounds to not to try to throw a lot of punches, to be defensive, and to try to figure this guy out. And then, once he had him figured out, to let him start to get winded and allow the fact that he has never trained for a 36-minute fight in his life, let alone been in one, hadn't even trained for one, and let that work against him. And then when Conor McGregor was winded and his cardio failed him, et cetera, then he can't even keep his hands up. Then, and only then, could Floyd Mayweather go at him throwing wildly hard punches with impunity, knowing that I'm not going to get hit back. The dude is gassed. It was what you would expect it would be from a man who was 49-0. 49 professional fights. Forget about the O part. Anybody who had been in 49 professional fights and been really good at it is going to have a huge, huge advantage here. And this particular man at 49-0 did exactly what a brilliant fighting strategist would do. He studied his opponent. He knew what he was capable of doing physically and what he wasn't capable of doing physically, and he fought that style of fight. Don't punch. Don't chase. Don't try to knock him out early. Don't put yourself in a position to get hit by him, even though he did land one really solid uppercut, did Floyd or Conor McGregor. Don't get in a position to be hit hard by this guy. Let 15 minutes go by. That's five rounds. Let 18 minutes go by. That's six rounds. Let's get into his gas tank and see what this guy who doesn't get into a gas tank has left. And when he's gassed, that's when I come on. Now, I'm looking at something that I should have looked at prior to Friday and prior to the fight Saturday. Kush, we had a little bit of a mini fighting roundtable. We had an MMA writer on, and we had a boxing writer on Friday's show previewing this thing. And I asked both of them, almost just on a whim, I just kind of thought of it, what about stamina? You just assume that in a fight like this, both guys are going to be in their peak physical condition. They're going to be in their peak ability to go a long time, to have their cardio, to have their strength, et cetera, up for whatever the duration of the fight is. Because, well, quite frankly, that's what you're used to seeing among professional boxers. Guys that could go 5 minutes in a, you know, a second-round knockout, or guys that can go 36 minutes in a 12-round decision. It's just how they train. What I didn't do prior to my prediction Friday, well, I've been making that prediction, but my final one on Friday, the day before the fight, and I didn't think about it until after it was over, and I saw how Floyd Mayweather played this from a mental, strategic standpoint. But here are the 10 most recent fight results for Conor McGregor in the MMA. In November, this past November, he fought Eddie Alvarez. TKO, 304 of the second round. That's 8 minutes and 4 seconds of fighting. Prior to that, Diaz McGregor 2, the only time he went the distance. The only time in his professional career. All five rounds, 5 minutes each, 25 minutes of fighting. Let's go to the fight before that. McGregor versus Diaz won. Ended up being submitted by a rear naked choke. Second round, 4 minutes and 12 seconds. That's 9 minutes and 12 seconds of fighting. Fight before that against Jose Aldo, KO. First round, 13 seconds. Fight before that against Chad Mendez, KO. Second round, 4:57. That's 9:57 of fight time. You see where I'm going with this. Dennis Silver, KO. Second round, 1:54. 6 minutes and 54 seconds of fight time. Dustin Poirier, KO. First round, 1:46. 1:46 of fight time. Diego Brando, first round, KO. 4:05 total fight time. He had a fight in 2013, 4 years ago, August 17th of 2013, against Max Holloway. That turned out to be a unanimous decision, but it was only a three-rounder. So 3 5-minute rounds, 15 minutes of total fight time. Prior to that, first round KO, 107. First round KO, 340. Second round KO, 410. So that's 9 minutes of fight time. You understand the point here. The average of Conor McGregor's last 10 fights is about 8 minutes. That's it. That's counting the 25-minute one and the 15-minute one that I just told you about. An average of 8 minutes of fight. I didn't look at that. When I asked our guests on Friday, Kush, what do you guys think about, you know, a guy's prepared to go 25 minutes versus a guy's prepared to go 36, I even said to them, you know, even though you have more breaks in a 36-minute fight because you're resting every 3 minutes, it's still 11 minutes total more activity time than the full MMA. And I just assumed in my head, very negligently, and I'm disappointed in myself, that Conor trained for five-minute rounds of 25, when the fact of the matter is, he probably doesn't, because the vast, overwhelming majority of his fights are over within 2 rounds.
Right.
He doesn't usually have to go into his gas tank for more than 10 minutes of fight. And now he's being asked to go 36? And by the time we got to the fifth round, he had been in for 15. By the time we got to the sixth round, he had been for 18. Did you see the gasping? Did you see how hard it was for him to keep the arms up, to start to defend himself? Did you see what a lack of activity there was on his part in terms of taking the fight to Mayweather? And by the time we got to the seventh round, he's in minute 21. The eighth round, minute 24. He just couldn't defend himself anymore. And he's lucky he found his way out of the ninth. I think if Mayweather really wanted to press it, he probably could have taken him out in the ninth. But he did let him survive the ninth and then the tenth. I mean, he was a defenseless fighter. It was a good stoppage by Robert Byrd, the referee. Even though McGregor, after the fact, said, "Let me go out on my back." That's an MMA thing. That's pride. You know, it's like in the MMA, for a fight to get stopped, you're pretty much, you know, near unconsciousness or you're tapping because of a submission. And here, he's like, "I'm still on my feet," or in his verbiage, "I'm still on me feet, and I can't really do magical lucky charms either." But you know, let him go out on his back was kind of what he was saying. But in boxing, the boxing world, in boxing reality, he was a defenseless fighter who could not hold up his arms. He couldn't defend himself. He was going to continue to take more shots like that until one of them perhaps did some serious damage mentally, and you don't want to have that happen. But that is where I got it wrong. We made it to the 10th. I said it would go to the 12th, and I said it would be a Floyd easy decision, and it would have been a Floyd easy decision had I not considered the cardio aspect of this. An average of 8 rounds of fight. Do you know what the average of Floyd Mayweather's last 10 fights is? 36 minutes, because he didn't knock anybody out.
I was going to say, isn't it round-wise, wouldn't it come out to like 10, 11, or 12 rounds?
Exactly. Exactly right. I mean, he just hasn't knocked anybody out in forever, and so his average is right around 36 minutes of fight. So you get into his 24th and 26th and 27th and 28th minutes, and he's a daisy, fresh, ready to go. You get into Conor, who's used to going 8 minutes of fight, and he was done. And that was the angle, the element to this, Jim. I thought I had it all kind of figured out, and I feel like my reasoning was sound. I didn't consider that Floyd would just not even try to score points in the first three rounds, the reason McGregor won two or possibly all three of those. I figured he would, you know, not go after him. Like I said, he'd be cautious and be a defensive fighter, but I figured he'd counterpunch enough to go bing, bang, boom, couple of points here, couple of points there. Oh, scoring goes to McGregor, or excuse me, to Mayweather, and I still thought he'd go a unanimous decision. But I never considered that Conor might not be able to make it to the 12th round simply based on cardio.
Yeah, you know, and I'll be honest, I was right there with you. I didn't really even consider that. And you said earlier, you know, in terms of Mayweather, that, you know, here's a guy who over the course of his career, he does study his opponents very well. And if there's one thing looking back that I remember Conor McGregor more or less saying, especially in the last week and a half, was I'm going to go out there and I'm going to start swinging, you know, early. I'm going to want this over in the second or third round. So Floyd knew that he was going to expend, and he did, the vast majority of his energy in those early rounds. Floyd more or less then said, I guess you can have those rounds from judges' decisions. And you know, it's debatable, one, two, and or three that the judges did give to McGregor. And then it was going to, as you pointed out, turn into more of a little rope-a-dope after that. And once he saw how tired Conor was, and yeah,
I don't even
by
think
that
it's
night,
once he saw it, he knew it.
Oh,
he predicted it. He knew this would happen. He studied his opponent a hell of a lot better than I did.
Right.
And knew that this guy's used to fighting 8 minutes a fight. And you know, because like I said, I you know, ignorantly, talking to those fighting guests we had on Friday, I said, it's 25 versus 36. It's only 11 minutes more total fight time. And there are more breaks every 3 minutes. But I didn't think to myself, wait a second, Conor doesn't go 25. Conor goes 8 on average. He went 25 once against Nate Diaz 2 fights ago, but the rest of them are first or second round knockouts. He only is averaging about 8 minutes a fight, and they just didn't think about it. But I guarantee you Floyd Mayweather thought about it, knew full well that this guy is not trained and ready with a gas tank to go, you know, 24, 26, 28 minutes in a fight. And sure enough, in the 10th round, before 30 minutes were up, bang, gone.
Yep. And he really started to look. I mean, I've seen the whole fight since then. I just didn't watch it live. But, yeah, he really, you could tell, starting in that 9th round, even reviewing it, I'm thinking, now I know why it ended this way, because you could see just
it was before the 9th. Well, I mean, for me anyway, I watched it live. Like I said, I looked at my buddy, and I believe it was either at the end of the 7th or the beginning of the 8th. And I think it was toward the end of the 7th. And I said to him, look at his arms and look at his stomach, you know, heaving, his chest heaving, you know, breathing in and out heavier. I said, this thing's going to be over by 10. I said by 10. That means it could have been 9 or whatever. It turned out to be exactly in 10. But I looked at my buddy and I said, he's going to be done in 10. He just cannot defend himself anymore. He does not have that gas in the tank. And my buddy said, maybe. And then when it happened, he looked over at me, and we clinked glasses together, his beard to my Diet Coke. So,
and Floyd saw it and knew it, and that's the most offensive fighting in that last round and a half, that Floyd did all day, because he was waiting for that moment to happen.
He had no fear. You know, Floyd Mayweather has always fought that cautious defensive style, did so even against an older Pacquiao. He did that because he has always had fear of being knocked out. He fights very intelligently, obviously, and he wasn't going to start swinging wildly on somebody who's got power like McGregor unless he had no fear. And in the seventh round to the 8th round to the 9th round, and of course when he finished it, that's when he had no fear. He figured, I can go up there and just start wailing because he doesn't have anything left. Even if he catches me, it's going to be with a noodle arm, you know? I mean, just a little powder puff bump, because McGregor had nothing left. So Mayweather played it perfectly. All right, I see Jimmy on hold, but stay there, Jimmy. I'm going to get my wild stat of the day and my quick timeout. I'll come back and take your call first on the other side. But right now, here it is, your wild stat of the day.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the wild stat of the day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports.
It's a baseball stat. The Indians this weekend not only swept the Kansas City Royals in a battle for AL Central positioning, they shut the Royals out for the entire series. As cool of a feat as that is to shut out an opponent for an entire series, it's not the team record, let alone the Major League record. Last time the Indians shut out an opponent for an entire series, three-gamer sweep of the Washington Senators back in August of 1956. The Indians team record is 4 straight shutouts in August of 1948. And the Major League record is 6 straight shutouts set by the 1903 Pittsburgh Pirates, who that June shut out the first 2 against the Giants and 3 more against the Boston Braves and 1 finally against the Phillies. So there you go. Pretty historic effort by the Indian starters and relievers in the week-end shutout of the Kansas City Royals. That is your Buffalo Wild Wings wild stat of the day. Back with your phone calls after this on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
By calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Alrighty then, you know it's time for fantasy football season, don't you? You know where to hold your draft, don't you? That's right. If you are a fantasy football commissioner and you want to have your draft in style, take it out to the Buffalo Wild Wings near your B-dubs. That's where you book your draft party. Because when you do, you get yourself a free draft kit. You also get a special draft feast of boneless wings, 3 sides, and 3 shareables, all at a special draft price to feed all of the owners in your league. So come on up. Start your fantasy season off right at Buffalo Wild Wings at participating locations while supplies last. And whether you're drafting or not, come on up to the B-dubs Fast Break Lunch. That's right, on the Fast Break Lunch menu, all the highlights from the regular menu at discounted prices every Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports. All right, I want to get right back into the fight reaction. Conor McGregor lasted 10 and a half rounds. Most people did not think he would against a 49-0 fighter who I think let him go a little deeper than perhaps he necessarily had to because he knew exactly what his fight plan was. But Floyd Mayweather won the fight. Conor McGregor won a lot of people some respect. The MMA, UFC probably won some respect in the course of that fight as well. What did you think? 866-240-1065. Jimmy in Toledo is indeed waiting for us in his regularly assumed time spot. Hey, Jimmy, what's up, man? Jimmy, can you hear me?
Yeah, hey, listen.
There he is. You know.
Absolutely. Listen, Conor, and he may not go a long ways in his fights, but they do train for 25-minute fights. I mean, obviously a fight with all the adrenaline is still going to take more out of you. He doesn't seem to get adrenaline dumps because he seems to have a supernatural ability to deal with pressure. But I do notice, like he said in the post comments, that, you know, he does find himself, you know, having lulls and fights. But here's the thing.
Well, you know what's your next point? Before you go to your next point,
I don't want to get off topic because that's not what I call about.
Well, that's fine. I'm not going to. You can continue. I'll let you continue. I just want to talk about that part, though. You can train for the full duration, but when you find that what your fight history has been, it's like Tyson. You know, I'm sure he was in great shape, but you know, when you're Kid Dynamite and it's KO1, KO2, KO1, KO3, KO1. You're just not going to train and have the experience of, can I stay? You know, you're not sparring for 12 rounds. You're not doing 12 three-minute rounds of sparring to feel what it feels like to be in it at that moment. So even though you train cardio-wise for all 12 rounds, if you don't experience it on a regular basis or an ever basis, you're really not going to know how you react to it until you're in it. And I think that's what Conor found out.
Oh, absolutely. He even said in training he was struggling with the eighth, ninth, and tenth in training.
He was saying that.
But here's what's kind of gnawing at me. Obviously, Floyd's strategy was to take him into deeper water. However, if you've watched Floyd fight, and I've probably seen 30 of his fights, and I remember him vividly as Pretty Boy Floyd in the whole nine yards,
sure,
in the Diego Corrales fights, and I actually saw him lose, okay? He lost that first fight to Castillo, but the thing is they robbed Castillo, and then he beat him up real bad in the rematch. Because he actually ironically hurt his shoulder, and he was thoroughly outscored in that fight, but they gave him the decision anyways. And it's ironic because the same thing happened to Pacquiao, and of course nobody cared. He didn't get his rematch,
and he wouldn't have.
It probably wouldn't matter because Manny was shot by then.
Disappointed about that fight. There's no way.
Right. I digress. The whole point is Conor came out and he won those first 3 rounds. And if you watch Floyd fight, he always starts off that way. He's not what you call a slow starter, but he's a cautious starter. But I've still never seen anybody land so many clean blows on him. And for a guy that wasn't supposed to lay a glove on him, he actually landed counters on Floyd. He actually didn't just, Floyd just wasn't always in a shell, not throwing. I actually saw. So what was funny, what surprised me is the assumption was that O'Connor's going to take it to him, quote unquote, in the early rounds to try to get him out of there. But Connor, like I said, is himself a counter puncher. And I was wondering, well, do you really want to box Floyd and stay at distance? Because that's kind of where Floyd flourishes, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly what McGregor tried to do. He kept that right hand.
And the thing is, he was
the first six rounds.
And that was ironically where he was. That's where he was successful at. He was successful doing what people thought he wouldn't be able to do. It wasn't until Floyd started changing his tactics. I don't know if you noticed this. I taped the fight. I recorded it. So I watched it three times, really. And he started coming out to the middle of the ring even before the bell would ring, because he didn't want to waste any time. He wanted Connor to fully expend himself, start the actual round, not waste a second. And Connor would basically start right away, pity padding, because he really didn't know what to do with Floyd close in.
And that's exactly what I was about to ask you about. What surprised me was the pity pack nature of Connor's punches.
But
he did not have any, you know, except with the exception of that uppercut. I don't know that any of the quote clean shots that he was able to land while he countered Floyd.
No, wait a second.
They were all arm punches.
No, hold on. He landed a number of good shots. The thing is when he was in close, he don't strike like a boxer, because striking in MMA is very different. A lot of guys don't sit down on their shots as much in MMA, because if you sit down too much, you can get taken down, because it's a whole different game in MMA, because obviously you can be attacked several different ways, where in boxing it's all the weight distribution and balance on your shots. It's a totally different thing, because you're not obviously worrying about kicks and having somebody shoot on you to take you down. Totally different game. So he doesn't really know how to punch like a boxer would, especially in close. But I got to tell you, Bob, he won the first three rounds because it was a combination of two things. Floyd being cautious, but he don't make no mistake about it. Floyd's always cautious, and he doesn't usually people don't usually find success and pick Floyd, you know, and get to Floyd as well as Connor did. So that is impressive. Floyd or Connor, and you can hear it in the.
If we were to score these things, out of 100%, I would give Connor maybe 30% credit for scoring on some of those punches, but I would give 70% of it to Mayweather allowing it. Mayweather had no interest in offenses in the entire first three rounds. He was a student studying the lesson, and he was going to, put to work with what he learned later on, which is exactly what he did.
I've watched entire Floyd fights over the years, and in professional boxers didn't have the success of laying hands on Floyd as well as Connor did. Now, here's the thing. The funny thing is the Showtime guy actually had the score 86-85 going into the ninth. Because
the judges did.
I don't know if you remember, and you were in a bar, so you weren't hearing it as it was being called.
Correct.
As this was going on, you could hear the begrudging respect. The Bernstein and the play-by-play guy, they were kind of shocked that Connor was acquitting himself so well.
Jimmy? I will tell you, I prefer to watch it the way I watched it, because then I wasn't influenced the way some people might be, and maybe even you were, by Al Bernstein or
somebody else.
Without sound and only what my eyes gave me. And what my eyes gave me...
Yeah, but you're spitting out the narrative that...
I'm going to watch. I'm going to see what his style is like. I'm going to study, all while he gets 9 minutes into his gas tank and then 12 and so on. And then I'm going to come out and exploit. And, I mean, he could not have written a better game plan, and he could not have executed it more flawlessly. And I got to give Floyd credit for that. I hate the guy, but I have to give him credit for that.
And I respect the guy, too. But, you say that, but then you're literally saying word for word the narrative of what Floyd put out after the fight. Obviously, that was a strategy he had, but at the same time, that doesn't discredit what Connor was able to achieve. I mean, Max Kellerman went so far before the fight to say he wouldn't land a single punch, not lay a glove on him. I mean, the level of disrespect for his skill set before this match took place was just ridiculous.
I agree. But, and that's why I said in my last segment, Jimmy, before I came to you, Floyd Mayweather won, but Conor McGregor won a ton of respect. And he did. You know, because
and here's the thing. You didn't address
this. I think he could do. But the show, again, at the end of the day, I think that what I expected it would be, which would be a 12-round unanimous decision, just a point accumulation machine for Mayweather against a guy who wasn't going to be able to penetrate that defense, you know, didn't turn out that way. McGregor did penetrate it a little bit. But again, if McGregor or Mayweather would have wanted to be more offensive early, I think he could have probably outpointed him in those first three rounds as well. He just had no interest.
See, that's
he knew he wasn't going to lose a points battle decision to Conor McGregor, so he was willing to give up two or three rounds early just to study the guy.
But see, that's the this is the thing that's upsetting me the most is you're saying he gave him up. The fact of the matter is, when Conor had his most success is when Floyd threw punches in those first couple rounds. Though being cautious, Conor countered him. That's what I'm trying to tell you. When Floyd started getting more aggressive in the latter rounds, Conor was already gassed then and he couldn't counter him. What I'm saying is the eighth round, there were people that scored the eighth round for Conor McGregor. He actually hurt Floyd Mayweather to the body. Nobody even discusses that because as soon as most of Floyd's damaging punches.
If you were with anybody who scored the eighth round for Conor McGregor, then you watched the game with a bunch of blind people who were listening to.
No, Tyron Woodley scored. Do you realize the Showtime scorecard themselves had Conor McGregor down by one round going into the tenth? It was 86-85.
Yeah, the Showtime scorecards were no.
Yeah, the Showtime scorecards. Do you think Showtime wanted Conor McGregor to win?
Forget about Showtime. The judges' scorecards had it not even close, and they were right. They were right.
I don't know.
Exactly
they weren't.
What I thought it would be, like I said, with the exception of the fact that those first three. Again, when I say he gave,
do you know what the
I
judges'
mean,
scorecards had? Two of the judges had Conor McGregor winning one round. Bob, there's not one person that has any. If you think Conor McGregor won one round in that fight, then.
Like I told you, I gave him the first three rounds. I gave him the first three rounds in large
part. I gave him
Floyd
four.
Mayweather gave him the first three rounds.
I scored him
for the first three, and that was it after that. Even though
I gave him four.
McGregor and hoping to see different scores,
I gave him four.
Couldn't lie to me.
I gave him four, and the fact of the matter is the disparity in punches landed, basically, the disparity in the punches landed occurred basically the difference being in the ninth and tenth round. And it's just like Conor said, what really occurred is he couldn't defend himself in the ninth and tenth.
Correct.
He wasn't stopped because of damage. He was stopped due to exhaustion. He couldn't defend himself anymore.
Agreed. That's why I said
period.
His cardio betrayed him. That is what cost him. He couldn't defend himself. And it was a good stoppage, by the way. You know, he's going to complain because he comes from MMA, and he ought to be pretty much close to unconsciousness before you lose any MMA, and he wasn't that here. So he complained a little bit, but in boxing, and I'm sure you realize this, it was a good stoppage. He couldn't get his hands up.
I've just taken
his time and hit him five more times with knockout shots, and it wouldn't have been good for anybody.
I've seen him fight so many. I've seen dozens of Floyd fights. And if you can, you can go back and watch most of them on YouTube. He's only been tagged seven times, really solid in his entire career. And the fact of the matter is that uppercut, I mean, if it hadn't just slightly glanced up coming off the chest, and then, I mean, it almost was completely pinpoint. He could have hurt him there, too.
But Conor, I understand that, Bob, but this was from
a guy that was not supposed to lay a glove on him, and it was a very good
Kellerman.
Fight.
Don't listen to Kellerman. That's silly. Anybody thought he'd be able to land on him.
I listened to half your guests say that. Half your guests said that.
But the thing is,
the truth about that uppercut, Jimmy, is, again, a great
fight.
It wasn't a lucky punch.
Jimmy, hold on, man. Even a really good fighter is going to follow that up with something. And what I was stunned by more than anything in this fight, anything, had nothing to do with Floyd or his style or strategy or Conor or his ability. It was just a lack of power. So many of Conor's punches that he did land had nothing behind them. You know, in boxing, there's arm punches and there's body where you get your body behind your arms.
Right.
And
that's
so devoid of power, which is not the way. I mean, let's put it to you this way. You probably do you watch Conor's MMA fights very much?
I watch boxing and MMA. Okay. You should see my cable bills. It's ridiculous.
Okay, well, then you know this. the vast majority of Connor's knockouts in MMA are not from one big blow. It is just an accumulation of punches where, you know, the fighter on the ground is defenseless after he grounds and pounds these people.
Well, actually, his biggest victory is a one-punch knockout, but okay.
Knockout shot. He showed very, very shockingly very little power in his punches.
His biggest knockout is one punch, but that's okay. It comes from the difference in striking, Bob. He's not a boxer, and so his striking... The striking in MMA and the striking in boxing is completely different things. He doesn't throw a boxing style punch.
You can even tell he tried to do a couple of hammer fists. He tried to throw a couple of hammer fists. Well,
if you notice, though, Floyd was smart for turning his back to him the way he was doing, because again, it's like Conor alluded to in the press conference, it wasted his energy.
Well,
Floyd's a smart guy.
But very aggravating to the rest of us, because the guys, you know, I was watching with him in the bar. We're screaming, turn around, you blank, because he's being a wussy.
Yeah,
it rhymes with wussy. You know, because it seemed like very weak. It seemed very, you know, very, very punk-like to you know, every time here comes Conor, he's starting to land some shots, you're going to turn your back, and it's going to be a break. Well, stop turning your back. Square up, man up, face up, and fight.
I would just recommend you go back and I would recommend you go back, watch those three rounds, and you'll see a lot of the shots that he landed were counters, and he wasn't supposed to be able to do yeah, something like that. It actually surprised me.
By the way, I would suggest you go back and watch that eighth round again and watch it with people who can see this time.
I will.
Appreciate it. 3:59. All right, here's what we got coming up. In the next hour, we are going to talk a little bit of NFL preseason football. Our man Scott Petrak is going to join us. Toledo's own Central Catholic product, Notre Dame product, DeShone Kizer, a second-round draft pick, is the starting quarterback for the Cleveland Browns. He will start against the Steelers a week from this Sunday, and it's going to be very, very interesting to see how he handles that pass rush. So we're going to talk to Scott Petrak about that. Also coming up at about 4:40, we'll talk college football. Bowling Green head coach Mike Jinks will join us and talk about the matchup he's got and they've got at Michigan State on Saturday. So we got college and pro football coming up, and more important than any and or all of that, Kush, is the devastation right now being felt in South Texas. Southeast Texas, Hurricane Harvey has left just catastrophic flooding damage. I've been watching very closely. I've been helping some people out doing radio in Houston over the last few weeks, and I can tell you I have a lot of friends and colleagues down there. It is every bit as devastating as you can imagine that it is. Let's all come together to help our friends and neighbors. Your friends dealing with this historic destruction can get your help if you are willing to just text the Red Cross to make a $10 donation. $10. Text the word Harvey to this number, 90999. Pretty easy, right? 90999. Text the word Harvey. That'll send $10 to the Red Cross, and your $10 will mean millions to the people who need relief, and they need it badly. Text the word Harvey to 90999. Please do that so that we can help our friends down there in Southeast Texas. And we're back after this.
But again, we're talking about Ida's first pro boxing fight. Here in round 10 against Floyd Mayweather. As Floyd Mayweather landing the right hands now at will. And tags McGregor again. Floyd Mayweather has McGregor on the ropes, literally and figuratively. How is the notorious one still standing?
And that's it.
McGregor is a stand-up fighter. He's undefeated in the octagon. I just went out there and done my job. My job is to go out there and fight, and that's what I did tonight. I'm not here to knock Marciano or no other legendary fighters. I praise any legendary champion that paved the way for me to be where I'm at. He's young, a guy that's 28, that's active. He's fighting, standing up fighting every day. He started off as a boxer from the beginning at 12 years old to before he even moved to MMA. So we're not going to take that. We're not going to discredit him or dog him out. He's a hell of a fighter. He's a stand-up fighter. In the MMA, he only lost when someone got him on the ground in the octagon, whereas in boxing, we fight just standing up from the shoulders.
He fought different because he knew he couldn't fight me the way he normally fights me. He had to change his style. I made him fight. He usually doesn't fight, so I made him come and fight. But look, nothing but respect to him. He came and he fought, and you've got to give respect to that. But I don't feel like I lost a fight. I feel like I lost a match. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Give me a kick in the mouth or something. Do you know what I mean? Put me out. Put me down. I'm fatigued and I'm tired, and then the ref steps in. It's felt like a bleeding amateur. You know what I mean? That's like something they do with the amateurs. If that was MMA, the ref wants to see a nose hanging off your face before he's even thinking of doing something like that.
That would be the last resort. These are two teams who want to find a way to complete this deal for lots of reasons. It certainly fulfilled the needs of both teams. And so, listen, the two scenarios before that is either Cleveland just signs off on the deal as it is, passes Thomas's physical, and moves on, or they get into a conversation here about adding to the deal, whether that's a first-round pick, a second-round pick, a player, a young player on the Celtics roster. But they're not there yet, and Cleveland is still going through all of their options in this scenario.
Starting a preseason game, but now to know that I'll be the guy heading into the season to help lead this team to a couple wins, this is obviously a really cool experience. Coach Jackson last week, when he called to tell me I was going to start for Tampa, he just let me know that if there's, you know, if all things went as we planned, that I'd be the guy heading into the season. After a good week of practice and obviously going out and growing a little more in this Tampa game, it just kind of fell in line. The drives are there. The playmakers are there. The, you know, we're going out and attacking each drive and playing with speed. That's all there. We just got to finish. You know, I think this last preseason game, whether it be the ones out there, the twos, is just an opportunity for us on offense to show that we can finish, because our defense is playing, you know, great in this last three games. And for us to compliment them, we got to be able to put the ball in the end zone.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling onward, we are. It's 11 minutes after 4. Great, great commentary in the first hour of the program on the Mayweather and McGregor fight. A little bit maybe in this hour on the Cavaliers demanding more from the Celtics in the trade for Kyrie Irving. But for now, we want to go back to football. As a matter of fact, maybe for the entire hour. Coming up at about 4:40, Mike Jenks, head coach of Bowling Green, joins us to talk about the opener this Saturday at MSU at Sparty. So Mike Jenks will be joining us. And now, let's talk about Toledo's own quarterback product. It is Central Catholic's Deshaun Kizer, who stopped off at Notre Dame for a little while before becoming the starting quarterback of the Cleveland Browns. And joining us now is our friend Scott Petrak, who writes for the Cleveland, for two different papers, I should say, in the Cleveland area, and also for the website BrownsZone.com, BrownsZone.com. Scotty, good to talk to you, man. How are you?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I am fantastic. Did you watch the fight?
I did not.
I know you were. On duty, obviously, with the Browns had the preseason game against the Buccaneers shortly before the fight, so I didn't know if you had a chance to take it in or not. But you did see a quarterback fight, and you saw the victor. It was not Brock Osweiler. I think that was kind of decided going into preseason game number 3. But Deshaun Kizer won the job. What I want to ask you first off, Scott Petrak, is how? Because Deshaun, as much as I was rooting for him in his first start in the dress rehearsal game, obviously, against the Bucks, was 6. Help me if I – correct me if my numbers are wrong. 6 out of 18 for 93 yards, no touchdowns, one pick, and a 28.2 quarterback rating. Did I get those right?
Yes, you did, Bob.
Then Coach Jackson must have set a pretty low bar for Deshaun to win that job. What went into that decision to name Deshaun the starting quarterback?
Yeah, well, we can start with Saturday night. The numbers were awful. I don't think the performance was as bad as the numbers would suggest. He didn't get a lot of help. There were a couple of drops that affected him. One was on third down in the red zone. They had to settle for a field goal. They have a better chance at a touchdown if Kenny Britt hangs onto a ball. Randall Telfer, one of the tight ends, dropped a 30-yard pass down the seam. So he didn't get a ton of help. They could have scored another. They would have scored more points if Duke Johnson hadn't fumbled in the red zone. So, you know, I think that was part of it. But the bigger issue is he got on one side – Cody Kessler and Brock Osweiler really did little to win the job. So I think Deshaun Kizer is the best alternative. And the other part of it is he continues to get better. And, you know, you can point to the numbers, but those aren't everything. And what Hugh Jackson sees is a young quarterback with a ton of potential who he feels has developed enough to say it's his time to start. And that goes from reading defenses to understanding the playbook to reading, you know, directing protections at the line of scrimmage. And I asked Hugh about this yesterday, and I said, when Deshaun comes off the field and you ask him what he sees during a play, is he getting it right? And he said, yeah, we have great conversations. He's seeing the field like he needs to. So I think that's what a coach is looking for, number one.
Scott, I'm glad to hear you lay out some of the mistakes made by the receiving corps and not giving him enough help, as you say, and then maybe the numbers would have looked a little bit prettier. That is always going to be a concern. It has been a concern. I don't understand. In fact, Hugh Jackson was asked after the game, if I'm not mistaken, are you thinking about going out to find more wideout help, to find a third guy perhaps behind Coleman and Britt? And he said, well, that's up to Sashi. Didn't they draft like, you know, 74 wide receivers in the last couple drafts? How come nobody is panning out, and even at this point in time, still early, but even at this point in time, Corey Coleman, to the point where Deshaun is going to have one of the worst sets of weapons, if you will, you know, the worst bunch of tools in the belt that maybe any quarterback in the league has?
Yeah, well, that's a big concern, Bob. I mean, they drafted four receivers last year, and as of now, Corey Coleman's the only one that has, it looks like he has legitimate upside. And Corey played well the other night. He made a couple third down catches for Deshaun, maybe four of them. One was a real nice play down the field. He also made a slant when they were backed up, or caught a slant when they were backed up against the goal line. He went high to catch an out route. So that was as well as Corey Coleman's played probably since week two last year when he had a couple touchdowns against Baltimore. So that's good to see. But after him, there's a drop-off. You know, Kenny Britt, the veteran they signed, hasn't been what you're looking for in the preseason. Now, maybe it's just because he's a veteran and the preseason doesn't matter to him. But even after those two guys, let's say those two guys are fine, you know, you need three, four, five guys in this league, and they're all question marks, and none of them have developed, the Ricardo Lewis's and the Rashard Higgins and Jordan Payton, who probably will be cut. There are questions at tight end because it's a young, inexperienced group, and all of a sudden you go, okay, we're trying to develop this quarterback. Is this the best way we can do it? And yeah, the offensive line's better, the run game should be fine, but the number one thing you need is receiving help, and I'm just not confident that the Browns have enough for Deshaun Kizer.
We're talking to Scott Petrak. You can read his great coverage of the Browns at BrownsZone.com, BrownsZone.com, because you probably can't get his newspaper that he writes for out, or newspapers out in Northwest Ohio. Okay, so Deshaun gets the job. Is Brock Osweiler going to be here to back him up, or is it going to be Cody Kessler, and is Brock going to be dealt?
Well, it remains to be seen, Bob. Here's what I think. If they can get anything for Brock, they'll ship him. And anything is probably a fourth-round draft pick and $6 million of the $16 million guaranteed in 2017. But nobody's been willing to give that up to this point. The Browns have been trying to trade him since they traded for him in March. So if nobody gets hurt around the league where a team feels, hey, Brock gives us the best chance to fill that whatever gap that would be, then I think the Browns will have to decide, do we cut this guy? And for me, it just makes no sense. Why would you cut a guy that you're still going to have to pay $16 million to? To me, is a good guy to have around. I don't think he's any kind of cancer in the locker room. And he's way better than Cody Kessler and Kevin Hogan. So, you know, for Browns fans' sake, I hope they don't do something kind of reactionary and just cut Brock because he was never part of their plans. I think you have to have some veteran on this roster, and he's the only one.
Scott, staying with Deshaun for a second, Hugh made a very important point, it seemed, of saying that this isn't just for now. This isn't a he's the starter for now, we'll see where it goes. He seems committed to, I'll ride out a three-interception game. I'll ride out a couple of three-interception games in a row. I know there's going to be a learning curve here, and there's going to be rookie mistakes, et cetera, and whatever happens, happens. But I'm going to play this guy. Do you think he'll be the starter, pending, you know, injury status, of course, but do you think he will be the starter for 16 games if his body allows him?
I do. I do, Bob. And we pressed Hugh Jackson on that right now. We just got done talking to him maybe half an hour ago, and Hugh doubled down. He said, I'm absolutely willing to ride it out with him. I think this guy has the right stuff. So I think that Hugh has come to the conclusion that Deshaun Kizer can be his long-term answer quarterback. Now, obviously, he has to prove it, and these 16 games will be critical in Deshaun showing that he's got what it takes to do that. But Hugh's not in any rush to yank him. The leash won't be short. And I think as long as Kizer isn't just a complete disaster, I think he gets all 16 games, and I think that's the right approach. You know, I mean, you got this guy in the second round.
What is
it? Not expected to go to the Super Bowl.
Scotty, what is the complete?
I mean,
you know, what if they're 1-7 and his QB rating is floating around, you know, 50 or 60 or something like that? Are we? You know, because remember, he said in the offseason, did Hugh Jackson, you know, the 1-15 was the biggest, most embarrassing
right.
thing he's ever experienced, and he vowed it will never happen again. If they get off to one of those kinds of starts, maybe it's 1-5, maybe 1-6, maybe 1-7, I don't know. And Kaiser,
yeah.
they're really struggling as a rookie. Brock is looking awfully tempting over there. I need a win.
Well, he referenced that again, Bob, the fact that he doesn't want to go through one of those seasons, but then he put the responsibility on himself, and he goes, if I'm a coach that's worth his salt, I'll get the best out of Deshaun. So, I think it would take an extreme collapse for Deshaun not to be the guy. And maybe that's a series of 3 interception games where he does it 4 weeks in a row. I think for some reference, Derek Carr was 0-10 in Oakland like 2 years ago. And they stuck with him. They started him all season. And now he's, probably one of the MVP favorites. So I think you can't get sucked into just the record, and it might be hard for Hugh, but I think he's approaching it knowing that the record might not be what he wants it to be. And then it becomes, okay, am I seeing progress in Deshaun? Is he getting better? And all those things we talked about, reading the defense and getting the ball out in time and not staring down receivers. Do I see progress in those areas? And if Hugh does, then, I think they can be 0-12, and it would still be Deshaun Kaiser, a quarterback.
We're talking to Scott Petrak, Browns beat writer. You can read him online at BrownsZone.com, BrownsZone.com, talking a lot about Toledo's own Deshaun Kaiser winning the job, the 27th starting quarterback for the Cleveland Browns since returning in 1999, which is simply very, very hard to fathom. Let me get to a couple of other guys, Scott. Jabril Peppers, as you wrote a few days ago, he looks like he has found his place, and that's going to be at free safety. He's been that Swiss Army knife, of course, at Michigan. We know that. He has done just a little bit of everything, a little corner, a little safety, a little linebacker, a little receiver, a little running back, a little kick returner. But he now it looks like he does have a position. He's going to be the free safety. He'll probably still return kicks. What did you see in him? He obviously had a big pick at the goal line to stop a drive in the early going against Tampa.
Yeah, Bob, he's impressed me. When they drafted him, I was not a big fan of the pick, and mostly because I didn't think there was a natural spot for him on defense. And I thought it'd be a waste to take a guy at number 25 when he's a huge projection. And to me, when he was at Michigan, he was best with the ball in his hands. And now you're asking him to step in. And at the time, we thought he was going to be the starting strong safety. Well, the Browns saw enough in this kid to take that gamble. And they thought he showed enough athleticism and ball skills where he could play free safety. And they were right. He looks comfortable playing the deep middle of the field. He can go sideline to sideline. He delivers a blow when he arrives. He showed the good hands on that interception. There's an overthrow over the middle, and that's what his free safety is supposed to do, is pick those off, and he did, and he returned it, for 23 yards. It looked like it could have been 45, but he stepped out of bounds. Mm-hmm. The kid's been a huge pleasant surprise for me. And all of a sudden, you start looking, you go, hey, Myles Garrett's legit. Jabril Peppers is legit. If Deshaun Kaiser turns out to be legit, then you start to talk about this is a class that kind of turned around the Browns.
You mentioned Myles Garrett, and I haven't talked about him mainly because I haven't heard his name called on sacks, but he did spend a lot of time in the backfield. He did indeed get some pressures. What are you seeing through 3 games of preseason development?
Yeah, he's got the 1 sack in 3 games, and he hasn't played a ton.
Oh, that's right, he did have one. I apologize.
Yeah, the one against the Giants. Yeah.
I asked you about it that week. You said you thought he would get one, and you were right. He didn't have one this past Saturday. Thank you.
Right, but he's in the backfield a bunch, and you can see all the moves and the reason they took him number one. He can dip his shoulder. I mean, the guy's 6'4", 272, and he gets low when he tries to go around the tackle, and he can get by the tackle. Just because you don't get a sack doesn't mean you're not having an impact, and I think we've seen that from him, where the left tackle struggles with him, and he's getting beat consistently by Garrett, and then the quarterback's looking to get the ball out of his hands, and then sometimes they chip him. I have huge expectations for him, and they need to come through once the season gets started, but I see nothing that makes me question him at all.
Yeah, and, it's not just about questioning him. It's about, is he going to be dominant? He needs to be dominant as
right.
the first overall pick. I think he needs to put – I think I asked you earlier on if you think he'll get double-digit sack totals this year, and you said probably not. He might stop at 8 or 9, but it's a precursor to something much, much better because his physical tools are off the charts. You still stick by that? You think, just on – what's the over-under for you on sacks?
Yeah. You know what? I've changed it, Bob. I've gone up a little bit. I think double digits is realistic. I think I'd be disappointed if he played all 16 games and didn't get to 10 sacks. I would be disappointed.
Give me your overall perception of the defensive line. We saw that a couple of interesting moves were made, including Dez being cut. What do you think the overall strength, or maybe not strength, but what do you think the overall analysis of the D-line is?
There's a lot of depth there. You're going to have a lot of young guys playing, especially inside, guys like Trevin Coley and Larry Ogunjobi and Caleb Brantley, if he makes the team. The guy's been hurt a lot. You know, we knew his name right around the draft because of all the controversy, but he hasn't played because he's been hurt, so I'm not sure he's guaranteed the roster spot. A lot of young guys, a lot of depth. In order for it to be as complete as it needs to be, they need to get production from the left end spot, and that means Emmanuel Agba, who had a sack Saturday night, Cam Johnson, Nate Orchard, if he makes the team. There's a little Carl Nassib. So they have a lot of guys in the rotation. It's just a matter of who kind of comes to the forefront. But, you know, a three-headed monster of Garrett, Agba, and Nassib at end looks pretty good, assuming Garrett's as dominant as they expect him to be.
And what about on the offensive line, that side of the ball? Cameron Irving, we've all been kind of watching flail and screw around and stink it as a guard. He stunk as a center, and now he's trying to play tackle. And I think your note on BrownZone.com said he's not guaranteed to make this team.
Yeah, I think he's in trouble. You know, they're trying to figure out who that kind of backup swing tackle is. And Cam was kind of the guy, but then he hurt his calf. He's missed the last couple games, won't play Thursday night. I think it's just a tough spot for him. And if you talk, well, he's got versatility, he can play off five spots. But if you're bad at all five spots, then what good is that? So it's hard for me to believe when teams around the league are going to cut 1,000 guys over the weekend that there's not a better tackle or better backup offensive lineman than Cam Irving. So I do think he gets cut, and it would just be one of those sad Browns draft tales because he's a number 19 pick in 2015.
Yeah, well, just add him to that list, like you said. Add him to the Trent Richardson, Johnny Manziel, Brandon Whedon, Brady Quinn, Justin Gilbert. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, how many of them just in recent years, not even going back to 99, but just in recent years under the last couple of iterations of Browns front office.
And how many are out of the league in 2 years? You know, exactly. I mean, they're all out of the league in 2 years. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Not just not with the Browns, but out of the league altogether. I mean, talk about just horrific talent evaluation. You know, that has been going on. That's exactly what the problem has been. Scott, there's a poll on BrownZone.com that I took note of. And I'm proud to say that I think I'm in the majority because your question was, with DeShone Kizer as the quarterback, how many games do you think the Browns will win this year? 0-4, 5-7, 8-9, or 10 or more? And I picked 5-7 because even prior to DeShone, I picked the Browns to go 5-11 this year, which sounds negative and cynical. But it's a five-fold improvement over last year's win total, so
yeah,
that's saying something. And so I went ahead and clicked 5-7, and that seems to be the most popular answer right now. 55% of the respondents say 5 to 7 games, and I think. And now I tried to refresh it, and I think I screwed it up. But it looks like 0-4 is the next highest. 5-7, 0-4, and then it gets to 8-9, and then last is 10 or more. Yeah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I have not given my final prediction for the season, but it's either going to be 4 or 5. I mean, that's where I'm kind of locked in. I just think, as much as I think DeShone Kizer is the right decision as starting quarterback, it's tough to win games with the rookie quarterback. The questions at receiver and tight end that we talked about, I'm just not sure the offense is going to be able to score enough points to turn the improved defensive play into wins. So I'm kind of riding that fence between 4 and 5. I'm an optimistic guy, so I'll probably wind up going 5.
And that's what most people do. I refreshed it. It's 55% say 5-7 on your poll. 36% say 0-4. So that's almost 90% of the people think that it's going to be between 0 and 7 wins. Not too many people more optimistic than that. Hey, Scott, last thing on DeShone Kizer. I heard one national cynic today suggest that the reason the Browns have decided to go with Kizer this year is they just absolutely need to throw him in the fire and find out if he can play because next year's quarterback draft is going to be great. It's going to be phenomenal. Lots of tremendous talent, including expected number one pick Sam Darnold if he comes out. Do you buy that, that this is just a we need to know because if we need to take another quarterback, next year is the time to do it?
No, I'm not dismissing it completely as a factor. But I think you could have done, you could have learned about DeShone Kizer if you started him week 8 or week 9. You would have seen enough. I think for Hugh Jackson to decide to start him week 1, speaks more about DeShone Kizer and less about, let's see what we got before we figure out if we need to draft Sam Darnold or Josh Allen.
All right, fair enough. And I got through the entire interview without asking you if Josh Gordon is coming back, so I feel very, very good about that. I'm done with that conversation, even though I know he's back in the news, and including on BrownsZone.com. Scott Petrak joining us. Scott, keep up the great work, my friend. I appreciate it. We'll talk again hopefully before week 1 against the Steelers. Sound good?
Sounds good. Thanks, Bob.
All right, thank you, Scott. Scott Petrak joining us. Follow him at BrownsZone.com, BrownsZone.com. And don't forget, the NFL preseason is nearly done. That means the regular season is nearly here. That means fantasy football is back, and that means FanDuel is back as well. FanDuel is fantasy football for everyday fans. You don't have to be a fantasy expert that has been putting out rosters and running their own leagues for the last 10 years. You can play as a beginner, a younger veteran, or the king of your own league. Look, there are new contests starting every single week at FanDuel. No busted seasons because one of your prime picks got injured in week 1. And there's something for everybody, too. Plenty of contests to choose from starting at just a buck. Just pick your contest, choose your roster, and watch your score in real time starting at just a dollar. It is outstanding. I have fun with it each and every year. We may put a listener league together this year. We'll get Kush to pick a team. I'll pick a team, and we'll get you in on it as well. We could have a lot of fun. Over 2.5 million players have won cash prizes playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Sign up today. Go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and then use my code France, F-R-A-N-T-Z. New users get free entry into the NFL Sunday Million with over $1 million in cash prizes when you make your first deposit on FanDuel. Just visit FanDuel.com. Sign up with the promo code France, F-R-A-N-T-Z. That's FanDuel.com, promo code France, F-R-A-N-T-Z, void where prohibited. All right, so we got NFL football covered. Now it's time for some college football conversation. Bowling Green at Sparty on Saturday. We talk to head coach Mike Jinks of the Falcons coming up next right here on The Ticket.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And welcome back into the extravaganza here on this Monday. Jim Kushland with you, and of course, college football gets underway, depending on the team you root for, either Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or even next Monday on Labor Day, there's a game. So college football back in full force this week. Of course, as we do all during the season, we'll talk with somebody from Michigan, and Paul Keels from Ohio State, to talk to the UT Rockets. But we're also, of course, going to talk once again about the Bowling Green Falcons. Of course, Talk Radio 100.7, and hopefully some of those Maction weekday games be able to be put right here on 106.5 The Ticket. We are your Bowling Green Falcon affiliate once again. And to help us talk about the Bowling Green Falcons and what they might look like heading into this 2017 season, which opens up this Saturday at Michigan State in East Lansing, we welcome once again the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons to the program, Mike Jinks, joining us. How you doing, Coach?
Doing well, Jim. Thanks for having me. Hey, let's about time to get this thing rolling again, huh? Let's finish well before we left off last year.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? I was going to actually start right there. So beautiful segue. You are a pro at this. Obviously, we know you guys had some struggles, particularly on the defensive side of the ball last season. But you did win the last three games of the year at Akron, Kent State, and Buffalo. Now, I know there's changeover, and we'll get to that here in a couple of minutes, Coach. But is there anything from not just a pride standpoint, but is there anything from those last three games last season, all W's that got your record to 4-8, that you can carry over into this season?
Definitely, Jim. It's confidence, man. And you know, you just needed to win one of those games. You know, we were 3-5 in conference play. And you go back and you look at those losses, I think three of the losses we lost by a total of 11 points. So, you know, we were, I think the Toledo game probably tried it really valiant effort and a loss that really kind of turned our season around to where we developed or found an identity, and some things just started to click for some of our young players. So yeah, without a doubt, we're excited about it. We took that momentum from last year. We had an unbelievable recruiting class. You know, we were very productive in spring football. We had a couple of those guys enroll early, which added some depth. So we got some guys back from injury. You're talking about guys like a Ben Hill, you know, Matthew Domer, who's an explosive player, Bryson Denley, Jack Walls. I mean, we're excited. Clint Stevens, not to me, we can't forget about Clint. He was all conference corner that's coming back, and So you bring in a class like that, you get some guys healthy, and then the future's bright.
We're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons here on the Extravaganza, here on the Ticket. And let's start on the offensive side of the ball, coach, with some of these players. And obviously, you know, last season you were hoping to go a different direction at quarterback with James Napke's final season. That didn't work out so well in the early going, ending up turning it over to the freshman, James, now a sophomore, of course, James Morgan. I know I saw improvement over the course of the season, especially into those final three games. I sure as heck know you as the head coach did. How key is it going to be to not have that kind of question, to know that it's going to be a Morgan under center, and that's what you guys have been planning for since day one?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, there's just a sense of, like, the key word is confidence, you know, and a lot of that comes with trust. I think we've got a good idea of what James' strengths and weaknesses are, and we're going to play to his strengths. He's got a big arm. He can make every throw on the football field. And probably the most important factor is our kids believe in him, and they believe that, you know, he has the skill set, and we all know that he pays the price. He's a student of the game, and we look forward to watching him develop.
Tell me about some of the other playmakers on this squad, because once again, even though, again, players in college, you know, it is what it is. You'll fluctuate some in from recruiting and then some out for graduation and all that, but it looks to have the makings of, once again, an explosive offense.
No doubt. The kid that jumped on the scene last year, Scotty Miller, he's come back, gained about 5-10 pounds, and kept that speed. We were able to add an outside piece, a young man by the name of Datron Guyton, that I'm excited to see play come this Saturday. You know, he's a 6'4", 6'5 kid that can really run. That'll help stretch the field and keep the middle of the field open up for Scotty. And then, you know, T.O. Redding's in his senior year, and we all know that when T.O.'s on, he's as good as anybody in our league. So from a receiver standpoint, we're fired up about the firepower we have there. Towards the end of the year, last year was probably a three-man rotation that we used with Cleveland and Box and the big guy, 45, Ernie Davis, I like to call him. Those two guys are back, and they've looked good. And a little, you know, Donovan's more of a downhill kid, and he's going to bang on you a little bit. And, you know, Josh's got little quicks about him. I'm excited to see Matthew Domer get a couple of touches, you know. Trent, coming into last fall, we really thought that, you know, he was kind of ahead of the pack and looking like he was going to be the guy. So getting him back and throwing him in the mix, excited about that. And then we got a freshman that looks like we're not going to redshirt because he won't allow us to. He's done some special things here during fall camp by the name of Andrew Clare that'll get some touches as well. So we've got weapons. We've got weapons. You know, it's just again, taking care of the football and managing the game.
Obviously, taking care of the football is an obvious, no doubt about it thing, but talk to me about some of the offensive line guys that will be blocking slash protecting for these guys. I mean, I'm looking at classes, and it's all, everybody's got a couple seniors, a couple juniors, you got some sophomores, you got experience and youth all rolled into one into this offensive line.
You know, Ryan Hunter was probably our sixth lineman going into last year, and then Jacob Bennett went down. He ended up starting for us at right tackle, and really, when it's all said and done at the end of the year, probably performed the best out of all the linemen last year. So he returns, and he's going to move over to left tackle. And, you know, you got Labus at right tackle, who's played a bunch of games in his career. And then in the rock in the middle, Timmy there, you know, he's going into his senior year, and we all know he's been starting since he was a freshman. We were forced to play Lorenzo Taborn last year and burn his red shirt, and it's going to pay dividends for us because now he's played nine games, you know what I mean? So he's not a rookie, you know. And then, you know, you got Jack Kramer, and you know, while this will be his first start, he's been around for a while. So they're a great group. If there was a concern, Jim, just to be honest with you, that the depth, you know, in a situation right behind them, we've got a lot of young kids that really don't need to be on the field right now. So we all need to stick together and make sure and live right and make sure we keep those first five, six on the football field.
We're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons, getting set to open the season, by the way, on Saturday in East Lansing against Michigan State. We'll get to that matchup and some of the schedule here in just a little bit. But, coach, I want to go to the defensive side of the ball. We're not going to rehash, especially early in the season, but the fact of the matter is, early on, guys were giving up a lot of points defensively, but as the season wore along, just as you said earlier, on the offensive side of the ball, came into play, I think, defensively, too, some of that confidence in the those three games you guys won at the end of the year, 28, 7, and 19 points allowed, respectively. And obviously, I got to believe defensive side of the ball is something that was really worked on in spring and camp practices. Talk to me a little bit about the defense and the hopeful improvement we'll see out of them this year.
No doubt. And you hit it right on the head. We've got to play better defense if we want to get to where we want to go. And, you know, as a head ball coach, what you've got to be able to do is be sure you manage the game correctly and you help with your defense and with your play calling. And we'll do that. We'll play as one, offense, defense, and special teams. But at the end of the day, they got to perform, and we, as coaches, got to put them in situations that they can be successful. You know, it was a point of emphasis, to say the least, throughout the spring and fall practices. I know that we've seen great improvement, and at the end of the day, a lot of those guys were you know, really weren't ready to play and shouldn't have been out there, Jim. But again, moving forward, I think we're going to benefit from that for years to come.
And you're also going to get some extra depth, I think, especially the secondary combination of recruiting and guys coming back from injuries. Yeah. Tell me about how that's shaking out.
Yeah, like we talked about Clint earlier, you know, all-conference corner coming back. And really, he's one of the four. You know, you got four guys right now that are rolling and competing for that starting job. You know, so that'll be one heck of a battle to watch. We were able to bring in a young man by the name of Fred Garth. It's long, and I think our fan base is going to enjoy watching what he's able to do on the football field. Jamari Bozeman is out indefinitely, you know, and we wish him well in a speedy recovery. Luckily, like we touched on prior, that if there was a position that we could have lost someone, it was that safety position with Tavares Wade, Ben Hale returning, and Jerry McBride also seeing significant playing time last year. So we'll be battle-tested, that's for sure. And, you know, I look forward to watching them fly around.
We're talking with head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons. Falcons opening on the road coming up on Saturday against Michigan State in East Lansing. A game we'll have for you, by the way, 11 o'clock the pregame time for the 12 o'clock kick over on Talk Radio 100.7. Talk to me about some of this out-of-conference schedule. It's at Michigan State, home against South Dakota next week, and then it's at Northwestern, at Middle Tennessee. So three of the four on the road, two on the road against big boys from the Big Ten, and Middle Tennessee's no slouch. So this is going to be, I think, a decently tough out of conference schedule. Do you like that as a coach, especially at the mid-major level here at Bowling Green?
Well, at the mid-major level right now, Jim, that's just, if you look throughout the country, that's kind of where we are right now. I think, especially in the MAC, if you look at us, Toledo, Western Michigan, it really doesn't matter. I think they're all going to have a couple of Big Ten teams or a Notre Dame on their schedule. That's just, you know, money games or whatever you want to call them. That's just what we've got to do to keep everything afloat. So that's part of the business. We understand that. You know, I kind of like the way that the schedule sets up for us. We get South Dakota here at home, and then, you know, we come back and we finish up the non-conference schedule with Middle Tennessee, which is a heck of a game last year. And really, it's a game in which I feel like we match up well, you know, and that's kind of what you want moving into the conference play.
Talk to me about the opener coming up on Saturday afternoon. It's Michigan State up in East Lansing. Now, they don't seem as strong as they were the last couple years in the Big Ten, but it's still going up to East Lansing, Coach.
They're still Michigan State.
Yeah.
You know, and they're still a very proud program. And last I heard, Coach D'Antonio is still a dang good football coach. So that'd be a heck of a challenge. You know, we're excited about it. You don't have to wonder where they're going to be, and sometimes those are the scariest teams that just line up and say, "Hey, we're going to beat your brains out. What are you going to do about it?" But we like some of our matchups. We truly do. You know, again, they've got some youth. So they're playing a lot of young kids this year, and you know, hopefully we can take advantage of some matchups.
And obviously, you know, other than the obvious Falcon W in this one, what are you looking for out of your squad in opener like this?
Continue where we left off, man. The thing that was more just disappointing, more so than anything else, was that in that non-conference schedule, trying to find our way, I don't think we gave ourselves the best opportunity to be successful from a coaching and a player standpoint. You know, we want to make sure that every time we step on the football field that you know, we represent our brand, Bowling Green State University, that the Falcon fanatics, it's a product that they can be proud of. And to be honest with you, Jim, there were some times last year that didn't feel that way. So we're going to lay it on the line. We're going to play the game the right way. And as long as we do that, we'll take the outcome.
Coach Mike Jinks, the head coach of the Bowling Green Falcons, joining us once again here on the Extravaganza. Coming up on Saturday, Falcons on the road at Michigan State in East Lansing to open up the season. 11 a.m. the pregame time over on Talk Radio 100.7. Coach, best of luck out there on Saturday, and we look forward to many a talk and hopefully many a Bowling Green Falcon W's as this season goes along.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you, Jim.
That is head coach Mike Jinks of the Bowling Green Falcons joining us here on the Extravaganza. I love talking with him. Such energy. And the biggest thing to me, theme from what you just heard there, building off of confidence. This was a season last year, had some issues, especially early, couldn't get quarterback straight. Eventually, James Morgan, who will be the starter this year, eventually came out of the fold. They gave up tons and tons of points. We all remember, we're not here to rehash the two times they gave up 77 points. That's in the past. But things improved as the season went along. And just when it looked like they were at their worst, they go out and win three straight games to end the season, finish with a much more respectable 4-8 record, and it's not great, but it's sure as heck better than the double-digit losses that was staring the Falcons in the face when that campaign was underway, and bring some of that confidence to hopefully play some good football. It's going to be tough, obviously, in these out-of-conference games coming up, starting obviously off against Michigan State. Then you get South Dakota for the Doit opener. Then it's on the road for two more at Northwestern, who a lot of people are liking again in that Big Ten. And Middle Tennessee, despite being in Conference USA, that is not a slouch program. Beat Bowling Green last year 41-21 at Doit Perry. So this one on the road. I hate to say that I think they'll be 1-3, but unfortunately I think the Falcons will be 1-3 coming in to MAC play. Now, 1-3 giving up 77 points in some games like last year is very different from a 1-3, but you're competitive. And I think we're more likely to see some of that coming up this year. It's very key that James Morgan knows, and so does the program, and so does Coach Jinks, that James Morgan is going to be the quarterback starting right from the get-go. They tried, you know, James Napke in his senior year last year. That didn't work. And the freshman Morgan, now a sophomore, blatantly had some growing pains. We saw it over the early to mid part of that season. But they're filtering in some new guys, obviously, especially in some of the playmaking positions. One way or another, this will be an offense that puts up points on the board, and that part's not going to change. The real key, though, is going to be how the offensive line on the offensive side of the ball blocks and protects for some of these guys. But the biggest key is going to be defensively. You're going to have to be able to force more turnovers than they did last year and really shorten drives. Stop drives, forcing punts or field goal attempts in ways that they just weren't able to do in the early part of that season. If they can do some of those things, even if the record says 1-3 coming into the MAC opener back at the Doit against Akron at the very end of September, that's very different than a 1-3, but it's like, oh my goodness, we're getting pounded out there. So 1-3 may not look great, but there's different ways of evaluating it. If they can do some of these improvement things, keep games closer, even if they don't turn into W's, 1-3 may not seem as bad as it was to start last year. I unfortunately think that's my prediction for the four out-of-conference games at least, but definitely this should be an improving type of season for the Bowling Green Falcons. And there's some, you know, in the MAC, the pollsters, for example, thinking that Bowling Green has the capacity to make it to maybe, you know, third or even second. Mostly consensus is Ohio for that Eastern Division. Now, the Western Division is the stronger one in terms of football, and it still is, at least for this year. You're still going to have Toledo. You're still going to have Western Michigan. You're still going to have Northern Illinois. In the East Division, though, you know, teams like Miami are still kind of down. Ohio's expected by many to end up winning the East, but especially if you play well, even if it's 1-3, you play well in out of conference, carry some of that confidence over into conference play, into MAC play, then you could start maybe racking up some victories here and there and be breathing down the neck of the Ohio Bobcats. It should be an improving type of season for the Bowling Green Falcons. And hey, that's going to do it for this Monday edition of the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. Stay tuned. Mike Miller on Drive Time's coming at you next. He's going to talk with Bronco McCart, just like on Friday, this for a post-fight of Mayweather-McGregor. And then Dave Briggs, a columnist for The Blade, will join him later, so an entertaining show. And then, of course, because we're in the beginning now of college football this week, we'll talk with some Ohio State guys, talk with UT, talk with Michigan as the week goes by. It also means a lot of the coaches' shows and roundtables will start up. So at 6 o'clock, Buckeye Roundtable, inaugural edition here on 106.5. Falcons Nest, speaking of Bowling Green, the Falcons Nest coaches' show, 6 to 7 over at Talk Radio 100.7. So you hear some more from Coach Jinx if you tune into that a little bit later. But Drive Time, Mike Miller coming at you next. Stick around for that. We'll talk with you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep their trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.